Jim, Al, Austin, it's very rare that we have all four of us on the phone at one time, but today's a special day. It's the 10th anniversary of when we launched StrategyPage.com. We actually registered the name in 1996. Jim and Al and I were involved in another project called the 100 Years War, which is sort of limping along. Hopefully we'll get some funding eventually that we can hire a real programmer and get it going again. But we saw where the internet was headed. In fact, Jim, I think that we were one of the first games out there on the internet because we jumped on the internet so soon.
Yeah, most of the other multiplayer games were on independent, you know, CompuServe or Genie and what have you, and very few of them were on the internet. What happened to us was we got distracted with Strategy Page.
Right.
Because that was growing, you know, that was another area where we didn't have much competition. In fact, in the sites that, or the rating services, as it were, that measure top sites in different categories, we've been one or two in military analysis, you know, for some years. We didn't realize it at the time, but nobody was really doing the kind of analysis we do, and for the most part,
right, and there were
still,
and blogs hadn't really come into vogue yet. I can't remember if there were blogs around at that time, but I don't.
Blogs were still a bit of a cult thing in the late 90s.
Right,
it hadn't gotten mainstream yet. That's why we didn't start as a blog. We started our model looking at the original business model. We were looking at Salon and Slate. And our original business model was subscription-based. But our fallback position was going to be advertising, which at that time, remember, this is 99, before the dot-com bubble burst. The advertising model hadn't quite proven itself yet because nobody really had the tonnage and the advertisers hadn't come over yet. Of course, in 10 years, that's completely changed. The advertisers are now telling the newspapers and the TV stations that it's not a temporary thing, you know, that hundreds of billions of dollars of advertising is moving in that direction. It's permanent. I mean, they're telling them that now. No more equivocation. And we're getting a lot of that. And indeed, you look at our revenue, it basically started turning around, you know, 04, 05, not so much because we were growing, but because there was more advertising money coming into the internet.
Right. And
so we got the tonnage and we got the advertisers arriving right about the same time, about 4 or 5 years after we started.
Right. And that's still the trend is we're seeing the ad dollars starting to come in. We're getting contacted more often and like that. Now, one of the interesting things, the inspiration for the site was actually some work that Jim and Al had done back in the 70s. They had worked on a magazine that was for the wargaming community called Strategy and Tactics. And the thing that had always appealed to me about the magazine was not the game part of it, although I like games and I look at them and play them a lot and like that, but it was the information that Jim and Al were putting in the magazine, especially the short bits. And because, you know, I, as a busy college student at the time, and would look at the bits that were there and collect the data. Then
you were an engineering student. That's why you were busy. If you were studying English Lit, you would have plenty of time to do something else. Anyway, go ahead.
Right. And then Jim wrote a book called How to Make War, and Jim and Austin wrote a marvelous book. And in fact, it's how I discovered Jim again, because I'd lost track of Jim after he had left Strategy and Tactics. But Jim and Austin published it. Was it 1990? Austin?
1984.
It came out in 85.
And so I picked up the very first edition of that and got reintroduced to you guys because it had been 3 or 4 years since you'd been working on Strategy Page. In fact, when I was a busy college student, I was reading the old issues of Strategy Page, really. Not the
Strategy and Tactics.
Right.
Strategy and Tactics, and you picked up a copy of Quick and Dirty Guide to War.
Right, Quick and Dirty Guide to War, and it was a marvelous book. I go, boy, this thing is spot on. And, in fact, I remember the chapter that I liked the most, Austin, was the chapter on South Africa.
Well, and you know, on the background on that, because of an unusual situation where I was living on the Upper West Side in New York, and going to a small church, All Angels Episcopal Church on West 80th, 6 weeks, over a six-week period, Archbishop Desmond Tutu was there staying in New York, and he used All Angels, one of the smallest churches in the city, as his quote-unquote home address. And I got Desmond Tutu to read and comment on my draft of that South Africa chapter. And one of his chief comments was, he says, "Mr. Day, you and your partner understand the tribal basis of society and culture in sub-Saharan Africa, and particularly as it relates to the South African situation." So not only did he give me a little written feedback on it, he and I discussed it one day after the early service and in the interim period before the second service. So it wasn't like, and it really his comments were mostly enthusiastic. So we actually had, I would say that Archbishop Desmond Tutu was a darn good reader for that first chapter, wouldn't
right.
you, Dan?
Yes, I would. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing was that we took the idea. Jim was inspired to say, "Hey, you know, let's." When I came to him with the idea to do the website, he says, "Let's get Austin and Al involved. Let's also recreate online the Quick and Dirty Guide to War and How to Make War, and those are our two main sections of the site."
This was actually my thinking at the time. I had to justify this. I had a day job. I had various other things I had to do. And it says, now, how am I going to justify losing another few hours of sleep? and what I thought of, and this actually worked out, was I had done this book, How to Make War, in 1982. And every 5 or 6 years thereafter, the publisher says, let's do another edition because things have changed. And they know they'll sell a whole bunch of new ones. And I was also bombarded, and still am, well, not as much since Strategy Page came out, with journalists. I'd get in their Rolodex, hey, you need some, you know, technical information on the military, call Dunnigan. And I hated getting those phone calls from guys overseas, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning. So I said, look, I can kill several birds with one stone. I can take care of the updates for How to Make War, and then with Austin, we started doing the same thing. Every 5 or 6 years, we go and do another edition of Quick and Dirty Guide. I can basically be writing the new editions bit by bit every day, so I don't have to go through this whole big rigmarole. It's a hassle, you know, revising a book, and maybe make a few bucks on that. On top of that, I've done several books with Al, especially the Dirty Little Secrets series, and Al and I both are basically pack rats when it comes to little noodles of interesting information, you know, sort of Trivial Pursuit for the truly, you know, obsessed. And if you read those books, you know what I'm talking about, little factoids, dirty little secrets,
right.
Things that, you know, the conventional wisdom that's wrong, and, you know, true things that you didn't know that you should. And we always had a lot of stuff left over after we turned in one of these manuscripts. And I always complained about this, what a waste. And it dawned on me, here's what we can do with this stuff, because the web is built for that. And that's why the structure of Strategy Page is based around short little bits. Well, we quickly realize, because we get what they call analytics, a lot of facts on who's hitting the site for how long and what they're hitting, et cetera, the metrics, as they call it. And we quickly discovered, because originally we were going to do longer articles, you know, a couple of thousand words, like a print magazine. Well, we quickly found out nobody wants to read that on the web. Anything over 1,000 words, forget it. You're wasting your
right.
time and effort. So you want to keep it down to a few hundred words, maybe, again, up to 1,000. If it's compelling enough, they'll tolerate it. But this, all of a sudden, Al and I had a place to put all the stuff that we've been, you know, just sort of filing away, never to be seen again by anyone. We put it out there. And it worked out very well, because that we had the right format. We had the constant flow of information, because what Al and what the Austin and I were doing with our book and with How to Make War was basically taking snapshots of a constantly moving, you know, situation. With the website, we could basically do the daily snapshots. We never did a blog format, because all of us have day jobs. And there's just no time. Or I guess none of us were inclined to rush to a keyboard or, you know, the BlackBerry or whatever, you know, every couple of hours and type something in, because basically we were not doing news. We were doing, as we point out in our mission statement or whatever, we're doing the news as history.
Right.
So we want to wait a little bit, not be the first one out there, but to get the last word on news, not the first.
Yeah.
Be a little more accurate in the process.
Yes, and of course, this could never have been done without a computer.
Exactly.
Right.
It wasn't it at all possible, and it basically fit all of our situations. And of course, I had to be dragged kicking and screaming to do new editions of How to Make War and Quick and Dirty Guide to Fort, because we were already doing it on the web.
Yeah.
Right.
And getting paid for it.
Right. Now, as we got started, it started out slow, but probably one of the first big events that caused the surge to the site was 9/11.
No, it was not that. No, the first big one that gave us a bump, I'm looking at the monthly report.
Oh, you've got the stuff in front of you there.
Exactly. I'm cheating, like I always do. The first thing that got us was when the collision, when the Navy electronic snooping aircraft that collided, with the Chinese fighter. And that was in the spring of 01. And we looked at that, and at that point, you gotta remember, we grew very slowly. The first 6 months, it was nothing. I mean, it was a few thousand hits, you know, page views a month. But by the time we were a year old, we were up to like 73,000, you know, page views a month. I remember we're doing like a quarter of a million a day now. So that's a difference in scale. But anyway, when we got to that early 01, it was in April, it jumped. From actually the news in March, it was 169,000 hits, and by May, that's when this thing sort of peaked, because they kept the crew captive. The crew, the Navy plane landed, the Chinese plane crashed.
Right.
It went up to 303,000, and we said, "Wow, gee, if there's an interesting, you know, military news event, our circulation really spikes," because at that point we were in the search engines. In other words, the web was aware of us. If you went to a search engine, you would pick up us along with the other news sources, and we just had better stuff. So when 9/11 came along, it jumped, let me see, in August of 01, I'm in 02. In August of 01, 288,000 hits. In September, 566,000.
And of course, most of those were post 9/11. In other words, those were far in effect the last 20 days.
Well, people kept looking for news, and what happened was you got the viral advertising, word of mouth. People and you know, blogs and what have you would say, hey, you know, look over here, because we were basically not reporting it, we were analyzing it, using our decades of experience with military affairs, our wargaming background, and our ability to say things in language that people can understand. That's what they kept telling me up at NBC. Hey, Jim, you explain all this stuff in English. Isn't that fascinating? Generals don't do that. In fact, that's what happened during the 91 war. They had a whole bunch of generals and me in there as military analysts, but by the last day of the war, I was the only one left.
Right.
Because I spoke in English.
Yes, Austin.
Dan, let me point out something about that P3C Ares. I think that's the Ares is the name of the electronic warfare version of the P3
Orion.
Of the P3 Orion. Yeah, I think they kind of call it that. When that broke, and I don't know that we did this in a calculated way, but it gave us an opportunity to show that we could talk about technology, electronic warfare aircraft. You've got little tech bits about what, I mean, this is all up on the site. You can see it. You got operational analysis. Why do we do this? How do they do it? You know, and the like. You even got, with over the first 12 to 14 days, strategic overview on, you know, China's borders. And if you went through our site And you didn't get it in a big, long 5,000 word document, but you had all these pieces with good headlines that would cue you as to what you were going to get, is that you would get all, at least some very useful and explanatory information about multiple aspects of this particular event, and not all done in a, whoops, it's U.S. versus China. It's a try to look at what the U.S. and Southeast Asian nations and the way Taiwan and Japan might fit in this, China's views and what would go into it. In other words, we got an opportunity to show an entire spectrum of analysis, which, as Jim just said a few minutes ago, you get a quick and dirty guide to war. You get how to make war, and then you get the historical context. So that that was an opportunity to show what we could do. And
yeah, I think the important thing that happened there was that we were integrating all of these things. We weren't just dealing with like the technical incident that happened, but what was the fallout in other countries? And I think that has been a consistent pattern since.
Right.
Yeah. In fact, one of the more interesting aspects of our growth is the majority of our users are outside the United States. We are much higher ranking in terms of popularity in places like India and South America. And I've spoken to a few those people, and they say it's one of the more balanced and reasonable sites in English. Everybody else seems to have a polemic in motion when they're reporting, a filter that you got to look at all news through. But whereas we don't, we just the facts. This is it. You might not like it, but that's what it is.
Yeah. Now, one of the interesting things, Jim, on outside the United States is we have to be one of the most popular sites in Sri Lanka, or used to be.
No, we still are. Again, because we were one of the few news sites that reported accurately on what was going on. Again, no polemics. Everybody has an axe to grind, it seems, in the news business. There's a party line you got to follow. We don't follow any party line. In fact, it's always been my policy, if you read carefully, we never mention politicians' names.
Right.
We never get into into basically the polemics. It's not
right.
That none of us have political views. We do, but we keep them out of the news.
Right.
And that comes from basically the wargaming background.
Right.
Not we're all, people who quit Jesuit seminary or something like that. We basically all grew up with that analytic look at an event. We're not pro-Napoleon, anti-Napoleon. We're just saying, well, what would happen if? Wellington did this, Napoleon did that. And so there's no politics involved any at all. It's an engineering problem, which is why we're so popular among the, the scientific and engineering, community. They can understand that. They can also understand polemical explanations, but they're not amused and they're not informed by that. And that's been one of our appeals. And a lot of people who read strategy papers don't even realize that's, even though we explain it in the About Us, but how many people read that?
Right.
They just say, hey, look at this. This guy. In fact, we have a very high overlap with, radical sites like Daily Kos.
Right.
We
which is really
get
interesting.
Mail from some of those guys. But you look at the analytics, and geez, a lot of people come over from Daily Kos. And I bumped into a couple people in Manhattan who, that's what they visit Daily Kos a lot more than I do. I make an annual visit. But they're there daily, and they know me, and they kid me about it. Says, yeah, we go to Strategy Page because everybody else has got an axe to grind.
Right.
And when you go to Strategy Page, you might not agree with what they're saying, but they're basically giving the facts as best they can be ascertained. And then they can go back to Daily Kos and twist it into whatever shape they want.
The next big thing would have had to have been the Iraq war, right, Jim?
We doubled again month to month. But at that point, we were up to, in the build-up to the war, in January it was 1.4 million a month. February 1.5. Then when we went in, it was 2.8 for March, but it was only a two-week war as far as the conquering Iraq goes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then it bounced down to 1.9. But then it started building up again, and we reported this. You know, I think even before, again, you can go back and check, even before the war was over, that Saddam, the Ba'ath Party, had a backup plan that if the country got conquered, they'd go over to guerrilla warfare.
Yeah.
And that's how we report. And at that time, I was also on TV a lot. They kind of look at me and say, what? I said, well, I'm just telling you what people are telling me from Iraq.
But
the Ba'ath Party aren't going to give up. And we explain why. A lot of them are war criminals.
Right.
You know, where can they go? There's no place to hide in the world anymore. You can go to Syria or Jordan, but what kind of backup plan is that? Mm-hmm. So for years, four or five years, they basically ran a guerrilla war using all the money they'd stolen, you know, from Iraq, because all the oil money was going to the 20% Sunni Arab minority. And we were the first ones to explain all that. And I'm amazed at how many journalists come up to me and said, yeah, you were the first guys to talk about that.
Right.
But to us it was obvious. That's just the history of the area.
Now, just right.
Austin and I were talking about describing the same thing 20 years, before in Quick and Dirty Guide to War when we did sections on the Middle East.
Now, Jim, do you remember right before the invasion that, and I don't know where you got these from, but somebody gave you some pictures of the Moab.
Oh, yeah.
And we were being called by CBS News and others about where did we get those pictures?
Borrow them from us.
Yeah. They were asking.
No, they just came in over the transom. That's something else we don't like to talk too much about. Most of our information comes from people who are there, meaning that I have to deal with a lot of military people. I have to shred a couple of times a month I get an email that strikes me as being something I shouldn't be looking at. I can't obviously forget it after I read it, but I do shred it. And then write a little note back to the guy who said it, or the gal in some cases, who sent it to me. I just say, OPSEC? ?
Right.
And they usually almost invariably get the message.
Yeah.
We get a lot of our stuff, a lot of our correspondents are people from the countries we're reporting on, Sri Lankans, Iraqis, Iranians. I mean, the web is everywhere now. It wasn't this way. We weren't getting this stuff 10 years ago. It just developed over the years. But that's apparently one reason why we have such a large overseas presence.
Yeah, now speaking of being there on our five-year anniversary, somebody was actually there.
Okay, so Dan, I know that's me. Where did I spend Strategy Page's fifth anniversary? I was on active duty in Iraq, serving in a planned section of multinational corps Iraq. I was not posting anything at Strategy Page. You talk about OPSEC. I was a plans officer and in ops and plans guy. So I'll tell you what, my thoughts, which you can see, components of these, on strategy page, I think particularly, now this is a different publication, a Weekly Standard, essay I did for the Weekly Standard on reinventing Iraq, which ran like December 9th, I think, 2002, which you've got linked on on point section. But that
right.
particular essay, which was talking about really transition to peace operations, you can see us, and I'm talking about our us on Strategy Page, talking about logistics issues in what becomes Operation Iraqi Freedom and transition to peace issues. I think one of the first ones shows up, I'm doing this from memory, and we can also be checked and Googled on this, but I think it's sometime in the middle of 2002 when we're discussing some of these. Now, I know I wrote a column that's up in the Strategy Page archive called Baghdad the Day After that runs sometime in 2002.
Yes.
And then that's my Creator Syndicate column. But the thing is some of the material that's in that column you'll see cropping up when we're talking about some of that material crops up in various places in the way that we organize strategy page. You know, both not just addressing Iraq or the Middle East, but looking at some technical aspects of military operations. And I do not know of any other website that was discussing quote unquote transition to peace operations in 2002, and I think we did deserve just as Jim's talking about the explaining why the Sodomists or prior regime elements the Saddam's henchmen got referred to, former regime elements, excuse me, FRG. You would see that crop up both in the Pentagon and also in the press. Why they were things that were driving them. Hell, the only thing they knew was how to kill and get back into power. Murder was their business, and plus, if they got arrested, they're going to get hung, you know, and tried for crimes they'd committed against the Iraqi people. Well, we were already looking at some of the things that are actually go into the components of planning a campaign, and those. It's not that you quote unquote got it exactly right. Nobody plans and operations, you never get anything right. I mean, I'm going to defer to Eisenhower, which says, you know, I'm paraphrasing, plans are nothing, but planning is everything. You're going through the analysis, and what we're trying to do on strategy page is give you those components of that analysis so that as events happen, you've got some background, and you've got a feel for how things are going to develop, and you know what the really critical issues are. Now, just to get back to your question on the 5th anniversary, I'm enjoying the 10th anniversary a lot. And I won't, not that I wasn't enjoying the 5th, but I'll tell you what, the 10th is a lot more pleasant. Okay.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things I want to do is focus a little bit on what Al does for us. Al, I guess we could sort of call our resident historian, guys.
He's how about our resident everything?
Our resident everything.
Yeah, fact,
but
you know?
He puts together the CIC section for us, which I post it once a week, and it's hard for me to I read through the whole thing, and the bits in there, Al, are just fascinating, that you come up with the historical little stories and like that. I mean, where do you find all that stuff?
Well, I mean, it's just a matter of, you know, as I read things, I take notes, and I've been taking notes now using a computer for 20-odd years. So the notes sort of accumulate. And when the time comes to feed you another batch, for the record, I feed Dan the CIC in batches of 10. So he has, you know, a couple of months' supply there. You know, time comes to do a batch. I just, you know, run through my notes and try to balance so that, you know, you'll notice, you know, that there aren't. It isn't always a world, you know, bunch of World War II stuff or something. This is a mix across time and types of information, and sometimes it's funny and sometimes it's serious and so on. And I get a lot of feedback from people. Who sometimes add information so that that turns up later in some other discussion.
Right.
And often, you know, it has a bearing on contemporary events. I'm trying to remember the thing on One-Eyed Generals ran. You remember that ran?
Yeah.
Well, it turns out here's a list of famous one-eyed generals, and then it turns out that Omar is a one-eyed guy. So it gives us a little, you know, modern touch.
Right.
You know, a connection in some sense, although he probably isn't as good a general as Hannibal was or even Wavell, you know. The other thing that affects it is a lot of times some of these things happen in the places that we're talking about now.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, that feeds in too. The Battle of Kanaksa in 3-whatever BC. The turning point during the Anabasis when the Greeks discovered they're trapped in the middle of Iraq and they got a choice of either dying or trying to escape. The battle was fought on what apparently is Baghdad International Airport today.
Uh-huh.
Two thousand years later.
You're flying into the airport and you're flying into the ground on which Xenophon walked, that sort of stuff. So it's it gives you these hooks into the events of the past and the present and arguably sometimes into the future, which people have occasionally commented since I also manage the Military History Today thing.
Right.
Yeah, people have occasionally commented on why the fictional characters are in there, like Harry Flashman and James T. Kirk.
Right.
Birthdays are listed, you know.
Right, yeah.
And of course, partly that shows that these people don't have a sense of humor.
Right, which everybody needs to understand. Our site has a sense of humor.
Yeah. And that some of the events recorded... also, there are some famous musicians and some famous authors, because that contextualizes the events that are going on around them sometimes. For example, Shostakovich, probably the greatest Russian composer of the 20th century, when he died, it was virtually unnoticed in the world press for weeks, because he had the misfortune to die the same day Stalin died.
And considering how not so well he got along with Stalin, there's probably a cosmic joke, inside of that as well.
Yeah.
Right.
But so that I think is part of what it appeals.
Well, Al brings up another point that history, as the four of us appreciate it and understand it, is a dying enthusiasm. You look at the metrics of our site, and you'll notice that the people who enjoy, CIC, the pure history type stuff, are older.
Right.
The younger crowd, their interests are basically determined by the mass media. For example, the most popular items every day are what I call weapons porn. In other words, little items on hot weapons, tanks and jet fighters. You're always going to grab more eyeballs with that. Now, why is that? Because the mass media play to that. Everybody loves a tank or a jet fighter. Well, not so much anymore with the F-22, but that's another story, which we covered in detail many times. But now, as far as wars go, wars aren't as popular as weapons porn. Weapons porn is by far the most popular thing, as any news producer on TV or newspaper editor will tell you. You're going to get far more of your eyeballs with a tank, you're rocking new tank. Well, with, we talk about, the battles of Alexander the Great, although I think all of us would find the battles of Alexander the Great a little more interesting than, the successor to the M1 Abrams. But even among wars, the ones that are going to be the most people are going to look at are the ones that are more immediate to themselves. In other words, the one Sri Lanka, most people could care less. What the hell's a Sri Lanka? Not where is Sri Lanka, what is a Sri Lanka? But if you talk about, the war on terror, 9/11, anything involving Americans or depending on where you are, like Indians obviously pump up our coverage of India and Pakistan quite a lot because we do very even-handed coverage of that whole area. I mean, there are half a dozen conflicts going on there. Most people aren't aware of that. But the Indians and the Pakistanis are, and they both tell me that, they find it difficult in their own media to get a fair analysis of what's going on between the two countries because people are very partisan. But they read Strategy Page, and they can get on the same message board and have a civil conversation. just using what Strategy Page is saying. But if they get on any other circumstances, they're at each other's throats because, you know, it's their team and the other team, and you know how that works out. It's you know, warfare takes second place to cricket as an area where Pakistanis and Indians will get very testy with each other. But we are prisoners of the great news cycle. And basically, you know, we cannot help but being, you know, it's a force of gravity, tidal forces. But we put the stuff in there that we feel is important. And I think bit by bit over the years, we are exposing more people to this. Hey, what's this SCIC thing? And I'm sure Al's gotten, you know, email that I never realized there was a world out there of history before, you know, 1900. And it's one of the wonders of the web that we're basically saving people from a life of ignorance.
Right.
Because if you just absorb information from the mass media, from television, what have you, you're basically leading a very narrow, you know, life. But if you basically go a little further, you find out there's been a lot going on for a lot longer than you realize, and a lot of it's damn interesting.
Right.
Go ahead, Al. I've got some comment on that.
Jim touched on something too that I just thought about. Because we troll a lot of news sites and, you know, and whatnot, and we have friends in lots of different places, we also get perspectives on things that are not, you know, born in the USA. You know,
right.
Sometimes it's an Indian or Chinese even look at something that we're really excited about, but to those folks, it's like they have a so totally different a perspective that we can begin to provide an alternative analysis to what we're thinking of.
Yeah, a lot of our analysis aren't done from the viewpoint of somebody outside the United States.
Yeah,
which is shocking to everyone.
I want to touch on a couple of things that, and actually this picks up on Al's comment. First of all, back on the history, one of the more important, I guess I'm going to sound like an extreme optimist on a new generation of younger people becoming interested in history, because I have seen the eyes that brighten when I talk about the Battle of the Karbala Gap in 2003, at the end of March in 2003, then talk about the Battle of Karbala in 680 A.D., which, what happened there? That's where Hussein was killed, and you have the final split between the Sunni and the Shia. Now, from what we know about 680, I won't go into the details, that may have been pretty bloody and fairly quick, despite many of the glorifying Shia accounts of Hussein's martyrdom. But the point is you can make that connection between 680 AD and the split between the Shia and the Sunni, and what happens in March of 2003, where if a fast-moving force out of the desert is going to get into central Mesopotamia, that's one of the most likely avenues of advance. And that is the kind of tidbit, extraordinarily explanatory and helpful tidbit, that you get on Strategy Page. Now, second point, Jim's talking about people feeling relevant, you know, getting relevant. They're writing about us. There has been one, and we played this game earlier in a podcast about what's the most important war nobody is covering, and Jim says, well, it's Mexico. That's sort of changed now. But go back and start looking as our coverage of Mexico's systemic issues, systemic problems begins late 99, 2000, 2001. We've been writing about Mexico. We started writing heavily about Calderon's cartel war. As a matter of fact, that's a name that we put on it in December of 2006, really, when late December of 2006, when it was launched, began covering it steadily and in as an exclamatory a fashion as we could in 2007, and it's only been what? Really the end of last year and this year that you've seen more extensive coverage in the mainstream media outside of certain media that you would see like the San Diego Union Tribune or the El Paso Times because they've got that war going there right on their border. But the background to this and our coverage of it, I mean, go look and go through the archives. And you, yeah. Somebody who bothers to do that is going to have, it's not that you're going to be able to predict how this is going to go, but sure, you're going to be able to understand what the issues are and some of the roots of the problems in Mexico and the increasing violence over the years that led to Calderon's response.
Yeah.
Well, what a lot of people are surprised with the strategy page is that we're covering news events, but we're not covering it like the news. In other words, the news directors are aware of a lot of them read strategy page for one thing, just like they used to call me up periodically on the phone or have me come into the studio just to chat. They are aware of these things, but they also understand that they cannot run a lot of interesting wars or military situations because they basically have to run the news like a play. It's got to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, you know, three acts. And if something, the public simply doesn't have patience to follow something that they know is going to go on, you know, for months and years and what have you. So a lot of things that we break and then only show up in the news, you know, 6 months later are because it hasn't reached that point where the news directors say, all right, we can jump on this now, but it's going to be over pretty soon. Well, so if you want to see the build-up, if you want to see the ups and downs, if you want to see, well, the soap opera version of history, you know, you read strategy page. But if you want to see, you know, the 1 hour, you know, wham bang, you know, beginning, middle, and end, a TV type version, then you go to the mass media. They're going to present it as a, you know, something that's got a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it's all over fairly quickly, which it isn't. But if you're going to sell it as news, you got to sell it, you know, as something that's going to be quick. But if you want to see it the way it really is, you come to the strategy page, and that's why, you know, we keep growing, because a lot of people say, you know, let's see what's brewing, because eventually a lot of things that we're covering that don't seem too exciting are going to go boom, and you read it here first.
Yeah. I'd like to end our discussion with two humorous things that have happened to us from a traffic standpoint. The first one was, do you guys remember when the Predator took out the terrorist? I think it was in the Sudanese desert with a Hellfire missile. It was the first time it was done.
I think you're talking about one of the shots in Yemen, aren't you? Not in Sudan.
Yeah, Yemen.
Yeah, right. It was Yemen. Yeah,
right.
A carload of terrorists, and it was a CIA, Predator.
Right. And the thing was, is that we had done a pictorial on the Hellfire missile prior to that, and me being the good engineer I am, I misspelled missile. Well, we got a huge amount of traffic because. Not only do I misspell missile, but most people misspell missile, and they were typing in Hellfire missile misspelled, and this was before the day that Google would do the spelling corrections like that for you. And so we got a huge amount of traffic of people coming and looking at our Hellfire missile misspelled. So the other one that was really interesting, Jim, though, and was just it remains fascinating to me this day, is somehow we had some pictures of polar bears up at the North Pole.
Polar bear eating the submarine.
Yeah.
Right. And
now, you got to remember, what a lot of people aren't aware of is that I got totally reamed out and yelled at, so to speak, via email from the wives of the crew of that submarine.
Yeah.
Because after our little photos appeared, the wives, among God knows how many other people, were brought into a room by the security officer, you know, for the squadron. the submarine belonged to, and they were lectured on basically he was saying, who let the pics out? You know, how did these guys get them? And of course later it would transpire that the people who let those pictures out were a bunch of civilian technicians working on the sub. And the sub was using an electronic periscope, where basically the periscope was hooked up to a digital camera. It wasn't really a traditional telescope, it was a digital camera up there. They just basically went click, a few other clicks, and they'd emailed it back to their buddies back somewhere in the Pentagon. And I was just on the distribution list. I got it, you know, by fourth hand. But within 24 hours, it was all over the place. But those poor wives, all they knew who could possibly be guilty was us.
Right.
Or me as the editor.
Yeah.
Until months later, until that submarine came back, did they talk and were able to debrief, you know, talk to basically line everybody up and ask them, who the hell sent this out? And it was a bunch of couple of civilians said, well, geez, what's the beef?
Right.
You know, a polar bear's trying to eat our submarine. Ha ha. You know, where's the security violation?
Right.
And of course, there was no security violation, but they thought there was.
Right. Traffic to the site was enormous for that.
Oh, yeah. We had an exclusive on that. Everybody had to come to us to get it.
In fact, Matt Drudge linked to us on those photos and actually took the site down for a couple of
hours. Brought our server to its knees.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, there's something else that's funny about that. The traffic, on our list, our open list, the FYEOD list.
Right.
The people began to talk about this, and some people were getting hysterical. Oh, they should machine gun the polar bears because they're inflicting damage on a submarine. And it was like, you know, guys, the polar bear can scratch the furniture a little bit, but that's about it. You know,
it's a pay job, and that's it. Yeah.
But the people, and of course that illustrates one aspect that because there's no analysis, people's reactions sometimes to things are so so instinctively one way or the other.
Oh yeah! In fact, when we said we did an article as well as the pictures, and I'll never forget, I went and did a little research, and I pointed out that the polar bears are having hard times because of the changing weather patterns. Because it is getting warmer up there. Although I think I also pointed out that if you look at the Greenland ice cores, the weather's been getting warmer and colder, much warmer and much colder than we've ever experienced it for several hundred thousand years. But that's another story. But I pointed out currently the polar bears are having a hard time. And they're very hungry because there aren't as many seals for them to go after. And so they probably thought, and I think I'm probably mentioned in the article, they saw a submarine and said, my God, the mother of all seals.
Yeah, right.
They were disappointed. Yeah, right. So, yeah. My God, look at this. We're set for the rest of the year. And crunch.
Yeah.
Where's the dentist when you need one?
Right. Well, it's been a great 10 years. I'm hoping that we have another great 10 years, and I'm hoping that we continue to grow and continue to add subscribers and permanent visitors to the site. So,
amen to that.
It's been a great partnership, guys, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thanks, Dan.
You're here.
All right.
Have a great day.
See you in 10 years.
Yep. Right? See you in 10 years. We'll do this again in 10 years. All right, guys. We'll see you. Bye.
Bye.
Bye, Dan.
All right.